Greetings and welcome to the Recombobulation Area. My name is Dan Schaefer. Thank you for joining us. It's been a discombobulating week. Lots going on in the federal government, beginning of Donald Trump's second term. Among those highlight items from the past week was when he and his administration tried to effectively push pause on the federal government. And there's a lot here to dissect and unpack and recombobulate with. So we're joined here by regular recombobulation area contributor and Marquette University professor, Phil Rocco. Phil, welcome to the recombobulation area.
Salut. How are you, Dan?
I'm hanging in there.
We've had a week,
but we're making the best of it here. It's wonderful to recombobulate with you as always. So I think first I just wanted to talk about what has happened this week or last week with the pause. I don't even know how you characterize it. The pause in the entire federal government, parts of the federal government, Medicaid, Head Start, Wheels for Wheels, I think were some of the main programs, but the Office of Management and Budget put out this memo on, what was it, Monday night?
Yeah, it's probably the most chaos-inducing two-page memo that's ever been. Think of the worst two-page memo that's ever been written at work, and then multiply that by a factor of several trillion. And that's the effect that this thing had. But OMB is arguably the most powerful bureaucratic agency in all of Washington. And I say that because OMB is not often an office that people think about. When you think about powerful agencies, I don't know, maybe you think about the Department of Defense.
Sure.
Right? Or the...
The Pentagon, the White House, right?
Yeah. OMB is really powerful. It's like the bureaucracy's bureaucracy. It determines what rules the bureaucracy makes. It's the real conduit between the White House and the president and the rest of the federal government. Because as much power as you might think a president has over the vast apparatus of the executive branch, it's only as really good as their ability to micromanage those details. The OMB is like the micromanager par excellence. So the OMB...
Really the nuts and bolts of like where the rubber meets the road in federal government, though, right?
Absolutely. And including in things like most of the way that the federal government works is not directly. The federal government, when it grew during the New Deal and during the Great Society in the middle of the 20th century... Most of how that happened was not through a huge growth in the number of federal employees. Most of that growth happened because the federal government was sending out grants, aid, loans to local governments, state governments, nonprofits. Basically, most of the work that goes on in the United States that the federal government does, most people take it for granted because there's not a big emblem on the side of whatever that thing is, Meals on Wheels,
right,
protection for victims of domestic violence, take your pick, the fire truck in Hull, the town of Hull, Wisconsin, it doesn't have a big federal eagle emblazoned on it, but that doesn't mean the federal government isn't working there. It is, but it's working in subtle ways. And in a way, it's like not until you have an administration that is so both hell-bent on manipulating the bureaucracy to its own ends and frankly bad at actually using the leverage of the government that actually you begin to see it. You sometimes you don't really know how government works until it shuts off.
Right.
And it's like they've just been going around flicking the light switches on and off. Like, does this one, what does this one do? What does this one do? And that's effectively what this policy has been like. So this reminds, it's like very much like what happened in 2017 in the early days of that. So we get these really chaotic orders. And of course, like you have this vast executive branch, which basically follows orders.
Right.
So it takes them seriously. So when the OMB...
Congress writes the law, the executive
implements it, right? Yeah. And so, when the OMB sends out this order, it says all federal grants and aid, like with the exception of like Medicare and Social Security, everything else is like paused.
Yes.
Until we get the quote unquote, like woke ideology, and literally in the text of the memo, Marxist equity, terms that, by the way, not defined in the memo, not really easily definable. It's not like they were saying we want overpayments to certain medical providers to be, you know, eliminated. That, you know, we're pausing over $1 trillion in grants. How much is hard to say. And then they had to release a memo that said, here's actually the 2,600 programs, right? So it's this like vast scale. And I was actually trying to quantify in the state of Wisconsin how many grant obligations would be paused. And it's actually very hard to quantify because there's the state, and that's like $28 billion in a biennial budget. But then it goes so far beyond the state because it's local governments. And it's, I came up with a number that's like around a little over $42 billion in a year of you know, or of obligations that are out. So it's a lot.
So $42 billion of federal taxpayer dollars that would come to Wisconsin one way, shape, or form.
Yeah, and it could be to the state government, it could be to local governments, it could be to nonprofits, it could be to schools. That's like the scale of obligations. By obligation, I mean it's money that's gone out the door from the Treasury, but also money that the federal government has committed to pay. It's signed a contract to pay, but it hasn't paid out yet. And that's the stuff you really got to worry about. So this is where I talked to a budget analyst in a city that's not in Wisconsin. And I said, you know, what is this looking like for you? And he's like, well, we were about on the precipice of making this big purchasing decision for the fire department. And there's a huge federal grant program to support the purchase of fire equipment, fighting wildfires and things like that. And he's like, well, we're going to purchase respirators and hoses and axes. And we're not going to do that now. And that was before the pause was rescinded.
Yeah.
But like, that's the scale at which this is kind of operating. It is really hard to summarize in like concrete terms. Oh, it's this and not that. And then the crazier thing was the Trump administration saying like, oh, no, but don't worry. It's actually not going to affect Medicaid. Oh, it's actually not going to affect food stamps or SNAP. But then obviously, like, you know, as early as the day the order was implemented, Medicaid portals were down.
Right. There were stories just here in southeastern Wisconsin saying there was a head start in Waukesha County. I think they were like saying that they were at risk of running out of money within the next 10 days and that we're going to have to start laying people off.
Exactly.
Right.
So, but in part because, you know, when governments, so the other thing, the sort of line that I saw kind of defending this is like, well, why would state and local governments need this money anyway? Because that is how fiscal federalism works in the United States. We've, over the last 60 years, created a web of partnerships that actually allow us to draw on the strengths of multiple levels of government to leverage the local knowledge that people have with the resources the federal government has to do things that neither of those governments would have been able to do on their own. Meals on Wheels is an example. Head Start is an example. Aid for Victims of Domestic Violence is an example. These are not controversial programs. They're basic programs. We take them for granted, but they're really, really important in just getting us through this, you know, life.
Mm-hmm,
But they rely on this web of partnerships. So it's not like the federal government in pausing this aid for this ridiculous kind of policy reason is like taking away money that, oh, you know, state and local governments should have been able to pay for that themselves. The entire design of these programs was meant to be intergovernmental. So that's sort of an absurd argument.
Yeah. And you know, this is one of the things that you study, that you've you know, spent a lot of time on, is just like kind of the relationship between different parts of government. And I think that is one of the things that is difficult to articulate a lot of the time, is just how interconnected so much of this is and how, you know, like you said, a lot of this is governments relying on other, you know, the federal government relying on the state government to trying to like make something better out of it, right? You know, it's always this type of thing in politics where it's like, oh, we want low taxes, right? Well, we don't want to cut that though, right? We don't want to cut Medicaid. We don't want to cut Medicare and Social Security. We don't want to cut this, that, and the other thing. And it does always come back to that when, you know, Republicans are always talking about, oh, we need to shrink the size of government. We need to do this, that, and the other thing. It comes back to this And I think what happened this past week really shined a light on it, is that a lot of people like these programs when you really get down to them. People like, you know, Meals on Wheels or Head Start.
Just the fact that they like them. Our economy depends for stimulation on a relationship between the public and private sectors. And so it's not just people losing access to benefits when these programs go away or get cut, which, by the way, we're not out of the woods on that by any means, right? But it is huge potential drop in economic growth, in purchase orders for suppliers that the governments rely on. It is, you know, you can't get out of the fact that government expenditure stimulates the economy. And when you try to do what they did, and what they, you know, might indeed try to do further with cutting back on Medicaid and all of these other things, we're going to have huge economic problems. Fewer people are going to have jobs.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's going to be less money changing hands.
Yeah. And I think, you know, it seems to me like what happened this week, and I'm curious your thoughts on this too, is that this and some of the other things that the Trump administration is doing is just kind of stress testing the system in certain ways too. So I did a podcast last week about immigration, and about one of the things we talked about was birthright citizenship, right? And so the order goes on to try and, like, go after birthright citizenship, and then, you know, it goes to the courts, right? And so, like, there's this immediate stay of the executive order, whatever it might be. But I think it is signaling the fights that are ahead. So the Trump administration is, you know, even if they know that this initial action is probably going to be unconstitutional and whatever it might be, it's setting it up for the fight ahead. Is that the way you see it, for kind of what this pause, I guess, for lack of a better word to call it, is doing, is setting up the fights ahead for, you know, just all sorts of different safety net programs, federal programs, like all these different types of things in the, you know, what Republicans will call the administrative state of the bureaucracy or whatever.
Yeah. I mean, so let's like go back a little bit, right? Okay. Because the first Trump administration was, by many metrics, pretty slapdash and haphazard and pretty ineffectual at advancing the policy goals that even Trump kind of set for himself. What was the big accomplishment on domestic policy? A big upwardly redistributive tax cut, but that was, and sort of mucking about in the bureaucracy.
Yeah.
But ultimately, you might not be surprised to learn that, like, consolidating power in a government that's as complex and polyarchic, you know, multiple centers of power as ours is pretty hard. So what's, you know, and I think one of the elements of the United States where you actually saw the resilience of democracy was the fact that we have multiple sites of power in our country. We've got states, we've got cities, we've got civic organizations that mobilized during those years and pushed back. And so it's not surprising to me that among the first of the targets in the Trump administration is the grant-making apparatus that supports civil society. In other words, that supports nonprofit organizations, that helps to support schools, institutions of higher education, mechanisms of cultural reproduction, right? Things that Trump really lacked access to in that first term, he's going after, you know, pronto in the second. And in a way, trying to change their cost-benefit calculations with how they engage politically. Because nonprofit organizations, cities, states, and so on, I mean, they were really quick to litigate on these things.
Yeah.
But if Trump is able to get the courts to engross his approach to power here, and that is, there was a memo released, I forget which news source kind of leaked it, but the whole ambition here was, with the grant memo, was to tee up the issue for the Supreme Court, in part because they knew that John Roberts, the Chief Justice, when he was in the Office of Legal Counsel in the White House many years ago before he became the Supreme Court Justice, he actually was pretty critical of this 1974 Impoundment Control Act that makes it really difficult for the president to do what Trump just tried to do. And so they want to tee it up so that the Supreme Court ultimately says that Congress trying to, you know, claw back its authority over the things that it's appropriated is in fact unconstitutional. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, in a way, the you can kind of see the policymaking intention here, which is to go at all of those sites of power that were the most powerful antagonists to the administration in the first term.
Okay.
And the thing is, to challenge their cost benefit, because during the first term, they pushed back hard. But if you weaken their resources, if you take things away from them, or you threaten to take things away from them, and you put their bottom line, in a way, on the table, you know, organizations, especially those that have like a fiduciary duty to their, you know, board of trustees and so on, they're pretty risk averse. Mm-hmm. They don't want to do things that violate the law. Mm-hmm. They don't want to do things that risk them not being able to fulfill their mission year in, year out. So if the federal government is really able to put the screws to them, right, we got a problem.
Yeah.
We got a problem for the basic apparatus of civil society that allowed the United States to not fall into a, you know, a much more serious kind of competitive autocracy in 2016 to 2020.
It's a little bit concerning, I must say.
Yeah, and I think on the flip side,
not just a little bit. Yeah, pretty concerning.
It is concerning, and I think we also I think it's important to like pull back and to have that level of analysis because yeah. the whole project here is like finding a way to take the things that make American democracy work, the kind of the rudiments of its strength, and to weaken them to the point where they can no longer really perform the functions that they perform. And I guess, you know, sort of optimistically, or at least, you know, to not be entirely doom and gloom about it, those lawsuits came pretty quickly.
Right.
You'll notice, right? And
the guardrails, right? We always hear about the guardrails when it comes to Trump and stuff like that. So I was watching, The Daily Show on Monday because I love Jon Stewart. And he was talking about this, you know, the reaction that every little thing that, you know, the kind of like cable news media, the MSNBCs of the world, will just fly off the handle at every little thing. And it's just like, okay, so when does it actually get real? And it does seem like this, I'm just going to keep calling it a pause for lack of a better word.
Freeze is the one
freeze.
I've been using.
Yeah, the yeah. freeze. That seemed pretty real, right? and just more broadly, even if they rescinded it a day later, even if whatever... Why this is pretty real is because, like I was talking about before, this is part of the stress test that they are putting the you know, the guardrails on.
Well, you right? can look at places where it's still where the it's there are actual funding freezes in effect yeah. with National Science Foundation grants, with National Institutes of Health grants. These are real policy changes that are going into effect. And guess what? People who have to plan. Budgets, they're trying to plan for the contingency of not being able to do what they do. Mm-hmm. So it's like...
So like we're in a state budget year, right? So like as they're crafting this year's state budget, as Tony Evers' team is putting together their proposal that, you know, the legislative Republicans will surely, I'm sure, take a strong look at and not just kick it to the curb like they do every other year. But like, How much of a calculation do state governments have to put into what's happening with just this stress test of a freeze?
Well, I mean, I think the, you know, certainly something like this freeze, whether intentional or not, it creates this climate of fear, of risk aversion, and so on. And I'm sure that will become fodder for the argument that, well, you know, we can't budget for X, Y, and Z, because who knows what the federal government might do, whether or not it's going to make matching payments and so on. Mm-hmm. So it creates that sort of, at least a, it attempts to license those sorts of arguments. Now, I would counter by saying what they just tried to do is patently illegal. Patently illegal.
That's the other piece of it, right?
You know, and I would say you can't, as a state government, budget in the shadow of an assumption that the federal government will act in a flagrantly illegal way to stop payments from coming to you. What if you do start doing that? Then what you're admitting is that we're already down the rabbit hole of, you know, a system where the rule of law is just quaint convenience.
Yeah. So do you think, what did you make of the response to the public response to this? And how do you think that is going to have an impact? Because there was obviously a big freak out when this freeze happened, right? And so is this something you think do you think the Trump administration backed down because of the public pressure? Or do you think the public pressure is something that they're going to lean into more? Because I kind of think it's going to be the latter. Because even as they do things that might be unpopular, might be whatever, it gets everyone's attention, right? And they're going to, and I think that is something that Trump understands that frankly, right now, Democrats don't, is that attention is a really big deal. And getting everybody's attention with something like this sets up the fight that they're going to have later, which is what I think is part of the strategy.
Well, it certainly changes what you're fighting about.
Yeah.
I mean, in a way, that's presidential power is often, I think, overstated. Much of what the president does to exercise power is a power projection.
Sure.
And then the question is whether or not other actors in society buy into the projection, right? And so I think that the president, certainly by doing something like this, I mean, that's real power in the sense that with rule following actors there, you know, people were getting ready to turn off spigots and so on. Mm-hmm. But the thing that I think matters in a situation like this is, in a way, I think the Trump administration, by going for broke in these kind of policy fights, is it reveals parts of the way the government work that people take for granted.
Yeah.
Because that's how the U.S. federal system is sort of designed. It's designed to kind of mask government, to submerge government. And thus, it allows that paradox of public opinion that you talked about before, like we don't really want government, but we actually want all the things that it does.
Right.
Sort of classic paradox in American public opinion.
Median voter politics.
The fact that the federal government, when it works, it often works silently and sub rosa. That's sort of what allows that paradox to persist. And one little piece of evidence that I think is valuable, political scientist Suzanne Mettler at Cornell and Larry Jacobs at Minnesota and a couple other political scientists as well have some really great work that looks at the way that public opinion on the Affordable Care Act changed. And what they find is that there's this like enduring, you know, partisan divide in how people see the ACA. But in general, what turned overall public opinion in the direction of supporting the Affordable Care Act didn't really happen until there was a threat of repeal. Mm. Only with the threat of repeal, again, because people are risk averse, they're loss averse, only when the possibility of something is, you know, being taken away, do you really begin to see how it all fits together, right? Like, yeah, you might not know much, you know, or care much or really, you know, want a big hulking federal government, but I think that there are some basic aspects of American public philosophy that are, you know, about supporting other people in the community. And once you start seeing the kind of, you know, realities of that now, you know, taken away, then I actually think that's like an opportunity to mobilize for political mobilization. Now, I think what you're talking about, though, is if you look at what the order for the memo was, the preconditions of that memo were, it was about reviewing all of these policies for what? woke ideology, right? And I think
DEI, all of these different things,
right? The litany of pretty amorphous concepts that I was talking to a reporter in Kansas City, and I said, "Yeah, I'm curious where the how they're gonna do a systematic policy review of wokeness in the LIHEAP, in the Heating and Energy Assistance Payments Program. What will that?" Then I started thinking about somebody in the agency that administers that program will have to write a protocol for doing that, right? But
I actually saw Minnesota Senator Tina Smith was tweeting about this, talking about how, you know, at International Falls, Minnesota, like the temperature was 25 below, and like what happens then.
So but I think that they will try to find places in the federal government, in grants and aid, in what schools are doing. I think schools are going to be a really important part of that, you know, political calculus.
Sure.
To deepen cultural divides and to say, in fact, the reason why you're not getting more heating assistance payments is because of this other thing. Like, they'll use it. But I think the important thing is, like, these moments actually create a possibility for telling stories about the way the government works in people's everyday lives that actually shows that, in fact, these terms are kind of a distraction. It's really not, you know, that's really not what the fight is about. The fight is about, are we going to use the power of government to try to make life a little bit better for most of our neighbors and to give people a fair shot? Or is government, as I think one of the big, I don't think the ambition of the Trump administration is necessarily to cut the size of government. I think it's about to redirect the resources of government in a way that allows it easier for Trump to expand the system of patronage that he's already begun to develop. You know, one of the difficult things for presidents in the modern era is that most of the jobs in government are civil service jobs that are basically outside of the sphere of presidential influence. Lo and behold, you actually have to have some sort of competence to do them. The reality is that what he's doing with Schedule F and trying to replace a lot of civil servants with political appointees, loyalists, he's trying to expand the number of chips he has to play with. And I think the same thing is true with tariffs. You know, tariffs, there is a completely, misunderstood or little understood and gigantic program of tariff waivers that gets very little congressional oversight. Well, when you impose massive tariffs, then you can give out tariff waivers to companies. There's been a study from Lehigh University that's shown this, is that companies that donated a great deal to the Trump campaign, they were in the last administration, they got the lion's share of tariff waivers. So once you create this, it's basically you create a terrible policy, and then in order for people to bail out of it, they have to buy themselves out of it. And that too becomes a way that you arrogate power to yourself.
Well, it's kind of some of those farm bailouts that happened during the first Trump term as the tariffs that he was implementing at the time had a significant impact there. And then a lot of the, you know, direct assistance that the federal government provided to those farms.
It's a protection racket. So, so essentially it's the mafia comes to your business and says, you know, hey, we go around collecting from everybody just for their own protection. And you say, like, I don't want to pay. And then they, you know, throw a grenade through your window or something, and your business blows up. Like, well, we're happy to fix it for you if you make the payment you should have made to us last week.
Right. It's not what you want, though.
No, but I also think it's like it's worth trying to be somewhat clear-eyed about what's going on. If you begin with the assumption that Trump has all of this power.
Yeah.
So you got to ask the question, then why is he doing all of this stuff? If you have all of this power already, why do you go, you know, why target organizations Like, if you have all that power already, why go after NPR and PBS, which their FCC chair is doing now, right? You do this stuff because you don't have power. And the question is, that I think civil society organizations have to confront, is how are they going to leverage the power that they currently have so that they don't lose it?
So from an from a local, state and local impact, or like, you know, again, I was talking about how you've studied like the levels of government, like what can state and local government do in response to this? Like, you know, Tony Evers and Josh Call signed on to this lawsuit opposing whatever was going on. I don't know exactly the status of it, where it's going forward, but like what can state and local, what can happen at the state and local level to push back or you know, try to find a better path forward?
Well, I mean, I think that state and local governments have a couple different important roles here. So first, state and local governments have standing in federal court. And we've already saw there were two big lawsuits. You had nonprofits and you had state attorneys general.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, there's like a bedrock of precedents in the past that basically say that when the federal government has agreed to give you a big sum of money, it can't then just like entirely play Calvin ball with what the rules for getting that money are.
Mm-hmm.
And that's actually, interestingly enough, that was the ruling on Medicaid in the first challenge to the Affordable Care Act. You know, the Roberts Court said that, you know, the federal government couldn't force states to expand Medicaid at the pain of losing all of their existing Medicaid funding, because that was like, in their words, like a gun to the head, right? The states had already made this, you know, so-called like contract with the federal government, and that contract couldn't be, you know, sort of like abrogated overnight. And I think that that's the kind of thing that like state and local governments can at least litigate on, because at the end of the day, they're the front lines of service delivery for a lot of this stuff. And they have an important responsibility to, you know, carry out the programs they carry out, and the federal money that's on the line there, protecting that is an important way they're going to do that. The other thing that I think state and local governments can do is, to the extent that they have, you know, some legal rights here, is actually begin to exercise them. Mm-hmm. And I think this is kind of what we're beginning to see with both cities and states, not just using their authority to challenge some of these immigration policies, but also to think about how do they use the resources they have to support people and institutions and organizations that are under attack from the Trump administration. I think we're beginning to see that emerge in different cities around the country. Cities actually using, there's a very interesting feature in American public opinion that I think is not surprising, which is that people have a far higher level of trust in their local government than they do in their state government, and a far higher trust in their state government than they do in the federal government.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that reservoir of trust is an important tool, because state and local governments, they have many more points of contact with their residents than does the federal government. And so that ability to communicate with people, even just inform people about what's going on, to inform people of what their rights are and so on, is pretty powerful. In addition to providing resources to support them, can be pretty powerful. And the other thing I think that state and local governments can do is that they can, in the policies that they create, in a way like prefigure what an alternative vision of the United States sort of could be.
Yeah.
And I think that there are states where that's happening. In a way, that's sort of the Trump administration, as we're seeing it, is kind of the after effect of a prefiguration done by Florida and Texas, right? If you want to know kind of like the way that things are going now, especially in areas like education policy and immigration, just look at what Florida and Texas have been up to for the last, you know, few years,
right?
And you'll get a glimpse of what is being sort of imported into the federal government.
So we should, I guess, look at, I guess the counterexample would be like Washington State or Massachusetts or like different stuff like that for, you know, the blue state. I don't want to use the word resistance, but.
Well, I would just say this, yeah. Right? It's like state governments have long been, I think, thought of as kind of like second bananas, like in American politics. But if you look, you know, American history, where did the right to vote for women, you know, first emerge? It emerged in Western states and sort of marched east.
Mm-hmm.
Where did the progressive income tax emerge? Right here in Wisconsin,
yeah.
You know, Social Security, the predecessors to, you know, Medicare and Medicaid, all of those ideas, you know, emerged first at the state level before getting traction in Washington. So
it's kind of the thing that I talk about a lot of time about democracy being built from the ground up and not from the top down.
Yeah. Well, and I think, and I want to contrast what I'm saying to, I think sometimes yeah. The way when I hear people say, well, people of a progressive bent, say like, well, I'm going to focus on state, you know, I'm going to focus on things locally now.
Right.
In a way that sounds like cope. Right.
Yeah.
And what I'm talking about is absolutely not using a focus on state and local government simply to distract yourself or to engage in some sort of coping.
Right.
In fact, that's actually the political project of creating actually existing examples of what you want government to use the power that it has to do. Right? Do you want it simply to enrich a coterie of people who are already very rich? Or do you want it to actually bring the vast majority of people into a slightly, you know, better position than they currently are,
mm-hmm.
And not have to worry all the time about whether or not that, you know, getting into a car accident is going to be the, you know, the end of their, you know, financial life. Like that to me is sort of what the stakes are and why, you know, again, it's not state and local politics is not necessarily a way of just distracting yourself from Washington, but actually kind of building a reservoir of power.
Right. Like a bit, yeah. It's like you're trying stuff on your single A team so that when you get to the majors, you have something tested and ready.
Well,
in a
way, to say nothing of the fact that where is the team coming from?
Yeah.
Right. Politics is, as we've learned nothing in the last few elections, right. That the ability to connect with people on a very local level, to turn out voters sort of one neighborhood at a time, and to like matter in a way in the life of everyday life of voters, like to the extent that you can't do that, you're going to have a very hard time winning elections.
Mm-hmm.
Period. It's always been, in a way, it's always been true in American politics. And I think recovering that, the promise of like localism as a way of like doing politics is probably going to be really important over the next, you know, next few decades of our life.
Certainly. All right, let's wrap things up here. What are you looking at, looking for going forward on this particular issue?
I mean, on the grants thing, I am sort of looking at. Just at a very like practical level, what is going to be happening over the next few, like, so the memo was rescinded, but I've heard from some organizations that work with like the Housing and Urban Development Department's communities continuum of care program that they have some credible fears about whether or not homelessness funds that were promised are coming. That fight is going to continue. So, I mean, in the very short term, I'm actually going to be looking at whether or not what the sort of daily level of government writing checks is. And I'm going to try to follow that pretty closely. I mean, I think in the medium term, I think we have to look at how this fight between the legislative and executive branches gets teed up again and what the possibility of another Supreme Court case on this is going to look like.
Yeah.
And I also, I guess I'm kind of curious about, you know, how even Republican members of Congress get drawn into the fight, because ultimately, you know, an executive that can completely squash their power to do appropriations, I mean, it does sort of cut both ways, yeah. You know, and that might be something to watch kind of in the future.
Well, you know, all of our constitutional originalist friends on the other side of the aisle seem to be remarkably quiet on a lot of this, but, you know, I guess that's to be expected. Phil, thank you so much for taking some time to recombobulate on the madness.
Dude, now I have to ask, do you feel recombobulated now?
I mean, I think...
I don't know that I did my job.
I think I'm recombobulated, but in a short term, but still very discombobulated in the long term. All right. Yeah. All right, well, thanks a lot, Phil.